Welcome to the GI Cancer Podcast, brought to you by the European Society of Digestive Oncology.
Hi all, I am Dr. Hélène Rondrian from Poitiers, France. I am pleased to record today a podcast, an ESDO podcast with Dr. Michael Foote. Dr. Foote is a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, New York, USA. And we are going to address that very specific topic, which is appendix cancer. But first, what do we call exactly appendix cancer?
Thank you so much for the great question, and I'm very thrilled to be here with all of you studying this rare, but I think important disease. So appendix cancer could be compartmentalized in a few different ways. I think about appendix cancer foremost as the type of cancer similar to colon cancer that can spread throughout the body, that has different stages. That type of appendix cancer is appendiceal adenocarcinoma, which is the more common type that we see that causes trouble in our patients. It's similar to colon cancer in that it arises within the appendix. Sometimes it can poke its nose out into the colon, and it can be a little challenging to figure out whether it originated in the cecal area of the colon or in the appendix. And there's ways the pathologist can try and figure that out. But most of the time, it does originate in the appendiceal cells themselves. These appendiceal adenocarcinomas can be very mucinous, where over 50% of their surface is covered in mucin, but not always. There are other types of appendiceal adenocarcinoma, including a very unique type called goblet cell adenocarcinoma. These cells can also be mucinous, but have neuroendocrine-like features, and they do behave differently than the mucinous adenos. And then a final type of adenocarcinoma is intestinal type, or colon type, which really behaves very similar to cecal cancer. It has less mucin, it doesn't have neuroendocrine features. And these are the three main histologies that we use. Some people also classify tumors based on the percentage of signet ring cells they have. Signet ring tumors in general are quite aggressive. So that's appendiceal adenocarcinoma. There is other types of appendiceal entities that are tumor-like, one of which is called a lamin, or low-grade appendiceal mucinous neoplasm. These are very interesting and bizarre entities that are almost like a cyst, but they can spread through the body. And the way that they spread, mainly in the peritoneal cavity, is through direct contact. So if patients have an appendix that bursts and there's a lamin inside of it, then it can spread and seed the peritoneal tissue and grow. It doesn't tend to spread anywhere else, but it can cause local trouble.
Very clear. Is there a specific population at risk?
That's a great question. So it's very similar to colon cancer in terms of the ages, the people at risk. There's a lot we don't understand about what causes these tumors. It's not clearly caused by obesity. It's not clearly caused by smoking, although us and others have looked at environmental causes. It's a disease that can affect young people. Similar to colon cancer, we have seen a slight increase in the percentage of young people with this tumor. It's extremely rare. It's about 1 to 2 patients out of 250,000 or more, so it's very rare. Dr. Holowadage and also us have looked into genomics, and specifically germline genomics, to see whether this is a cancer that could be inherited based on someone's family history. We did find that in about 10% of patients with this disease, 10 to 12%, there was a germline variant identified with sequencing. However, when we took the additional step in our paper published last year in the Clinical Cancer Research Journal, we found that when you look at the actual tumors, none of these tumors had two hits in the same gene. In other words, this germline variant was not clearly a causal source of this cancer. It was just incidental. It was just picked up accidentally. So we don't think that germline sequencing actually influences these tumors. The classic people that come in with this are people that have appendix pain, appendicitis, and because of a tumor growing and bursts the appendix, the gastroenterologist and the surgeon are very surprised to find an appendix tumor in the sample. And often these patients are referred to a cancer center later for consideration of a right hemicolectomy, because the idea is if you've had the appendix out and the appendix tumor has snuck into the right colon, there might be some residual microscopic cells in the right colon. And so often, if there's an appendiceal adenocarcinoma identified, we will do a right hemicolectomy. We don't do that if it's just a lamen, because lamens are not invasive to that degree. They can spread to the peritoneal cavity really through droplet methods, but they don't grow very well inside the colon. So we don't typically do a right hemicolectomy for lamens.
Okay, so we get that there is no specific screening for appendix cancer because apparently it's not required, and that the surgical strategy depends on actually the histology. If we go further, could you get us further in the management strategy? Is chemotherapy efficient there?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. So the guidelines for appendiceal adenocarcinoma largely represent colorectal cancer. Because there's not huge trials for this disease, we borrow most of our treatments and strategies from colon cancer. So for early stage appendix cancer, stage 2 disease where it's confined to the appendix, we personally don't feel like chemotherapy is that effective for this disease. Because there's not very much data right now, we're working on a paper, we still treat patients that have high risk features, including a very large tumor, a T4 tumor, if the appendix burst, if the grade of the appendix cancer is poorly differentiated. If those features are present, there are people that will treat the patients with chemotherapy after a surgery, which is the main management strategy is surgery. If there is lymph nodes with the appendix tumor, we found in our paper that we published this year in the Annals of Surgical Oncology that the patient has a very high risk of relapse because appendix tumors are not as fit as colon tumors. So if the appendix tumor was strong enough to spread to the lymph nodes, it's typically a bad sign for the patient. It means that the chance of them having a strong enough tumor to form metastases in the abdomen is very high. And that's really where these tumors like to spread. They really, really, really like to spread to the peritoneal cavity. Unlike colon cancer, you don't see them as often in the lungs or in the liver, especially the mucinous adenocarcinomas. Most of our management strategies are trying to prevent this disease from coming back in the peritoneum. So stage 2 disease, sometimes we give chemotherapy, although many of us don't think it's helpful. Stage 3 disease, we will, because the chemotherapy is similar to colon cancer, FOLFOX chemotherapy. Stage 4 disease is a conversation between the surgeon and the medical oncologist. Again, this disease often is confined to the peritoneal cavity, and patients can do very well when they have something called a cytoreductive surgery, meaning they have an open abdominal incision and the surgeon goes in and removes all visible disease. It's a morbid surgery, but people can go into a deep remission and sometimes can even be cured with these surgeries where they go 5 to 10 years without having disease come back and then they can even have another surgery. Chemotherapy is really based at this point on the grade of the tumor. If the tumor is a lamen or well-differentiated tumor, chemotherapy does not work. There is clinical data on this now. There was a crossover trial done by Dr. J.P. Shen and MD Anderson where patients that got 5-FU chemo for their well-differentiated tumor really didn't do better before or after the chemo. The growth rate of the cancer remained the same. And the reason for this is that well-differentiated disease grows very slowly. So the first thing that oncologists who aren't familiar with it will do is be very worried and say, oh my gosh, this is going to behave like colon cancer. We have to treat this immediately. But often you can even observe patients with well-differentiated tumors for years, just watching their symptoms, their scans. Symptomology is a huge part of when we decide to act in the stage 4 setting. If the patient does have a higher grade tumor that's a moderately or poorly differentiated tumor, then chemotherapy can have a role to shrink the disease before the surgeon does their operation. So it's always a conversation with the surgeon. Should we go in now? Should we give 3 to 4 months of chemotherapy first? If the tumor is moderately or poorly differentiated. So just to summarize, for stage 4 disease, if it's a low-grade tumor, we often watch the patient, and if they start to have symptoms, then we operate. We don't do chemotherapy. If it's a moderately or poorly differentiated tumor, then often we'll do 3 to 4 months of chemotherapy first with doublet combo chemo, and then we'll do an operation afterwards. So that's typically how we think about it. It is a little different than colon cancer.
Yes, and radio a dialogue between the surgeon and the medical oncologist, and you need quite detailed pathological data to make your decision. What about molecular profiling in appendiceal cancer? Are there any specific features?
Yeah, that's another great question. So the really remarkable thing about appendix cancer is that the genomics of appendix cancer are very different than colon cancer. You see, in the classic appendiceal adenocarcinoma, you see much fewer alterations in APC compared to colon cancer. You see very high rates of KRAS, even higher than colon cancer, where 60% or more of the tumors can have a KRAS mutation in appendix. And you see GNAS mutations in a very high proportion of these tumors. Up to a third or more of these tumors will have a GNAS hotspot mutation. GNAS is a G protein coupled receptor kinase that basically hydrolyzes GTP to spread that energy to other molecules within the cell. And it's similar to KRAS in that regard, to GTPase. So we think that this mutation helps activate the growth potential of these cells. And it's also been associated by us and others with mucin production, which is really interesting. And I mentioned to you these tumors tend to be very mucinous. So we think this could be one of the mechanisms by which they do this. GNAS also has been associated with peritoneal spread, even outside of appendix cancers. So we think what might be happening is the appendix tumor has a GNAS mutation as part of its development. It produces mucus, which creates a nice microenvironment for it, and it facilitates its growth in the peritoneal cavity. So those are the main differences. One of the interesting things about GNAS is that there was a paper that was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology this year in 2024 that showed that in patients with GNAS mutated mucinous tumors, use of a CDK4/6 inhibitor actually slowed their growth rate. And so it's very interesting, this strategy of using a CDK4/6 inhibitor in GI cancers. It's not the most common model, but we think that GNAS, in summary, may be both a prognostic as well as a predictive protein. We're working on that in our lab.
Yeah, you and others uncovered the aggressive potential of GNAS, as you mentioned. And in the end, does GNAS alteration impact the clinical presentation and the treatment? You mentioned the CDK42 inhibitor, but rather focusing on prognosis?
Yeah, it's a good point. So in our appendix cancer paper that we wrote in 2023 in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, we really saw four main subtypes. Patients that have KRAS mutations only in their stage 4 appendix tumor do really well. In fact, no patient in our data set died of their cancer with that profile. One patient died of COVID-19, not of cancer. If the patient has a KRAS mutation and a GNAS mutation, and I'll say these two often go together, then the prognosis was much worse than if the patient just had a KRAS mutation. However, the worst subset of patients were ones that had a TP53 mutation. These tumors were very aneuploid, they were aggressive, and in fact, most of those tumors did not have a GNAS mutation. So there's this really interesting sort of middle ground where patients have the GNAS mutation, they have worse overall survival than if it's not there, but it's not quite as bad as if they lose TP53. The other things that we found that were important is that the GNAS mutated tumors were less responsive to chemotherapy. And this was a phenomenon we saw in appendix cancer, and then we researched this in other types of tumors and published a paper in 2024 in the JCO about this, and the same effect happened. When you compare GNAS mutant versus GNAS wild-type tumors of pancreas, colon, neuroendocrine, liver cancer, lots of different types of cancer, all of them had a very, very similar phenotype where they had less responses to chemotherapy with the GNAS mutations. They had more chance of the tumor being mucinous if it had a GNAS mutation, and there was a higher chance that the patient would suffer from peritoneal metastasis. So we think that's a very interesting connection, a pattern with this mutation.
Thank you so much for this summary of both clinical, histological, and molecular aspects of appendix cancer. I guess we will follow the progress in knowledge for GNAS in the ongoing years. Thank you so much, Dr. Foote.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to ASTO Podcast.